Huh?
V woke to Sister Ariel shaking her. The windows were still dark, and the only light in the room was from a single candle. V sat up and gazed blearily at the Maja, who was red-eyed and wearing the same tent-like dress she'd worn the day before.
What are you doing?
I found it. I can help you.
Help me with what?
Get up. I'll tell you on the way.
V dressed and followed Sister Ariel. Sister Ariel said nothing until they were on one of the punts that would convey them to the chantry.
Long ago, there was an Alataran emperor named Jarald Hurdazin. By all accounts, he was a skilled and wise leader. In his younger years, he solidified Alataran control from what is now Ymir in the east to the west coast of Midkiru. What is now Wedrin and Modai were his last conquests, and with his marriage to Lainisa Geralt, the seeress of Gaia, essentially its princess, the lands that are now Kura came under his control as well. And there he stopped, mostly because of her influence. He spent the next 20 years consolidating his empire and for the most part bringing justice and prosperity to the lands he had conquered. He was, however, magically poisoned by one of his many enemies. The poisoning was called Erl, but the Magi could only delay its effects. They treated him every day, but soon determined that Emperor Hurdazin would die within 2 years. Obviously, this was a closely held secret, and obviously, they called as many green Magi and Magi as they could. To make matters worse, there was no heir, and in agreeing to bring Gael to the Empire, Gael's king had insisted that Gerald and Lainisa be married with rings like yours. For a man of his power, finding such rings was no problem. And though their marriage was first political and magical, all the histories I've read agree that Gerald and Lainisa deeply loved each other. The Green Magi found nothing to heal Gerald, and they soon found that Lainisa was infertile. Women with great talent sometimes injure themselves with their magic, and infertility is common in those who use too much magic, or too much too soon. Like, the Emperor put as many magi as he dared trust to work on both magical problems. He believed that Lainisa might hold his empire after his death, but if she were infertile, that would only delay the collapse, and he didn't want to be yet another emperor whose empire died with him. In the end, it was Lainisa herself who discovered a way around the ring's bond.
She did?
Don't get excited. Now we're here. Say nothing until we reach the library.
They walked through the halls of the chantry. V wondered for a moment that the building was beginning to feel like home. The dim magical torches that illumined the walls and followed them seemed normal now. The austere marble arches comforting in their strength rather than menacing. In a few minutes, they were deep in the chantry storerooms, far below the waterline, a place V had never been allowed to go. It was neither dark nor dirty, but it did have an air of abandonment. Numbered oak boxes lined the room to the ceiling. The one small desk had an oak box already upon it. Instead of opening the box, however, Sister Ariel closed it and put it back on a numbered shelf and grabbed a different box 2 rows down. V understood that she had left out the wrong box in case some spy checked what she was studying. At first, V wondered why the boxes were oaken, but then she looked again and saw the spell sunk into the wood. Each oak box had one spell to strengthen the box and make it watertight, one to make it fire-resistant, and one to suck air from the box as it closed to preserve whatever was kept inside.
Magically reactive materials are kept in special rooms on the next floor. These archives are for mundane records only. Because of how they're preserved, they only have to be copied by industrious tyros such as yourself every few hundred years, if they're not frequently opened.
The box opened, and she gently lifted out sheets of pound parchment that to V's eyes looked scarcely 10 years old.
At the time of Gerald and Lainisa's marriage, binding rings had been forbidden for almost 50 years. They were still common among royal families, of course, who were rarely willing to surrender them. The rings continued to cause misery wherever they were used, and all Magi became more and more convinced that banning them had been one of the best decisions that Chantry and the Brotherhoods had ever made. Every group eliminated knowledge of them and how to make them to the best of its ability. This did lead to bloodshed a number of times, especially among the Visana, the Makers, who to this day are a small brotherhood. When Lainisa figured out how to circumvent the magic, there was a great debate among us. Some wanted to follow her research, to find a way to fully break the bonding. The majority, however, feared that any dabbling in those arts again would lead to a full rediscovery of how to bond. The suffering of those few who were presently bonded was weighed against the possibility of vast suffering if bonding were rediscovered by the unscrupulous. I don't know if you've experimented with your bond, V, but it does have an element of compulsion. That's what made it break the God King's compulsion on you. The order of the ringing makes the compulsion in your rings flow from you to Kyler.
What? You mean?
I mean if you told Kyler to walk on his hands to Sonaria, you'd find his body somewhere in a mountain pass with stumps where his hands had been. It's a compulsion stronger by far than what the God King used on you.
But there's a way out.
Not out, child. Because you're the mistress of the bond, however, you can do what Lyanissa did.
Which is?
She used the compulsion of the bond to force Gerald to divorce her and marry a princess. She was then able to suspend the bond to allow him to produce an heir.
What happened?
He died, but the Empire lived, minus the country of Gael, which was deeply insulted by Gerald divorcing their seeress. Lyanissa served Gerald's new wife and supported her regency for 5 years, until a new empress marched against Gael, at which point Lyanissa committed suicide. The enmity between Alaterra and Kiora didn't cool for centuries, and would probably be raging right now if the countries still bordered each other. The point is, if you wish it, you can suspend the bond. Partially. A magician named Jessa worked with Lyanissa on the rings. Jessa was in the camp that wished to learn about breaking them, and when the Chantry forbade it, I suspected that she tried to defy them. Jessa was a healer, but she was also interested in gardening, so I've been looking through her books. They're not terribly enlightening. Others did far better, and she wasn't an important Maja, so I think no one ever studied her books. If they did, they would have found what I have. She's hidden it in plain sight, and not well. She was no cryptographer. After I read the books, I began applying ciphers. Then I worked on her marginalia. If you could read Old Curran, you'd see how ridiculous this is. She'd capitalize a strange word in her margin notes, and everything from that capital to the next capital was part of a secret message. If you look at all the marginalia from the last to the first, the message unfolds. I don't even understand everything Jessa wrote, but I think you will. No. One more thing. V, I haven't told Kyler or Aline about this, and I won't. This is your burden. It is yours to decide if the price is worth it.
12 hours later, with dark circles under her eyes, V found a cheerful Aline making breakfast.
What is it? Are you well?
I know it's a month late, but Aline, I have a wedding present for you.
They were calling him Solon Stormrider. They said that his hair was growing in white because of the snow-laden seas through which his longboats had plunged. Or they said it had turned white after the winter sea had chewed on him and found him too tough and spat him back out. Of course, his hair had been growing in white since he'd used Kurok, long before this mad winter. And he'd explained that to the soldiers and sailors who'd begun to follow him. But they preferred their own versions. Now it was spring, and Solon was heading back to Queen Wariamo, having destroyed her enemies. He had bowed before her after saving her life, and she had told him, fury edging her voice, that the price for her hand was cleansing the Isles of the Rebellion he had started by killing Oshobi Takeda. Katie didn't like being weak, didn't like needing anyone, but her temper always cooled in time. At least, it used to. Everyone had expected Solon to wait for spring and take an army to each of the Takeda Isles. Instead, he'd begun at once, alone. In a canoe, he'd paddled the 18 miles to Durai. There, he'd given the ultimatum he would give a dozen times through the winter.
Surrender, swear fealty to the Queen, and give me all your weapons. or I shall slay every man who fights and take those who surrender as slaves.
Ghulam Takeda had laughed at him and died, along with 18 of his soldiers. Solon had returned with 24 odd soldiers in a longboat. He had delivered them to the new Makedan and slept in a dockside tavern, not seeking so much as a word with Katie. By the time he'd woken and gone out to his canoe, a score of the craziest sailors he'd ever met and a captain with a vendetta against the Takedas volunteered to join him. Soon, storms battered them every time they left port, and Solon's command of weather magic grew by necessity. But Sethi Winter's storms were tamed by no mage, and it was a fight every day. Several times, the Takedas who had faced him were so stunned that anyone should be able to make the crossing, they had surrendered on the spot. And when Solon returned to Hokkaido yet again, victorious yet again, he found the Takeda soldiers he'd conscripted were a fully trusted part of the Sethi army, oddly proud to have been defeated by the Storm Rider. Now it was done. The Takeda's home island, Orai, hadn't expected an army for at least another 6 weeks. The leaders were totally unprepared, and having almost 3,000 men to Solon's 400 did them no good. Before the Takeda army could be rallied, its commanders were dead, and Solon's magic-enhanced voice had offered generous terms to the living. The rebellion was crushed, and nearly all the dead were Takedas. With the first day of spring, Solon's little fleet sailed into Hokkai Harbor. They were greeted as heroes, and the crazy sailors who had joined Solon first were now soldiers in truth. Sailors dropped their gear to greet them, captains forgot their shouting, and the shorebound traders and vintners streamed through the streets to greet them. The flood carried them to the castle, and Solon's heart thudded with fear and expectation.
Katie, please, my love, don't take my glory as an insult. Without you, it all means nothing.
The crowd brought him to Whitecliff Castle, shining in the spring sun. Katie stood on the dais where months before she had almost been deposed. She wore an ocean blue nagika and a platinum tiara with sapphires. She raised her hands.
How fare the Isles, Storm Rider?
The Isles are at peace, Your Majesty.
Katie's face was still somber. She let the people cheer, then raised her hands once more.
They say you are a mage, Storm Rider.
I am.
They say you are a god, Storm Rider, to have defied the winter seas alone.
Neither a god nor alone, Your Majesty. A loyal son of Seth who tracked the seas with men and women fearless as tigers, fiercer than storms, and hungrier than the seas. Not even winter seas could stop such from serving you.
They say you were our prince, Storm Rider. They say I've stolen your throne.
A prince I was, of an ancient house that my elder brother debased and dishonored. He broke the holy covenant between king and country, and I stand a prince no more. Should you command, I will sail to the sunset or to death's rocky shores. I am but a man. A man who loves you, my queen.
Then Solon, Storm Rider, Solon Tofusin, come forward and receive your rewards as a mage and a loyal son of Seth and a man.
Katie first presented him with a pendant with a glowing ruby lit from within, burning with ancient magics. He'd never seen it before, never heard of such an artifact, but before he could consider it, she put a crown on his brow. It was his father's crown, a circlet of 7 gold grape leaves mingled with 7 golden waves.
A ruby fit for a mage, a crown fit for Seth's most loyal son, and if you will have me, a proud and troublesome woman ill-fit for any man.
Except one.
And he swept her into his arms and kissed her. V didn't know how Aline had explained it to Kyler, though she had known when by Kyler's sudden burst of confusion and hope and longing through the bond. Tonight was the night. She'd gone over the magic a number of times with Sister Ariel. As Ariel had warned her, V wasn't severing the bond, only partially suspending it. First, it was only suspended while V was actively using magic against it. If there was any good news, V thought, it was that Kyler was a virgin. That embarrassed him, but V thought it was extraordinary and kind of cute, which embarrassed him further. Now, though, she simply hoped it meant his lovemaking with Aline would be brief. V had told Aline, and Aline had decided not to tell Kyler, that the suspension of the bond worked only one way. Kyler wouldn't feel V, but V would still feel him. V had her materials, an itchy wool robe that she hoped would distract her from whatever physical sensation bled through the bond, and a pitcher of wine for afterward to obliterate her thinking. Sister Ariel didn't exactly approve, but she didn't forbid it either. V could only hope that Kyler was one of those men who promptly fell asleep after sex, because once she released the magic, he would feel her once more. If Kyler knew V was basically magically eavesdropping on his lovemaking, he would worry about it. Aline fully believed she would die by spring, and she deserved as much of Kyler's attention as she could get. Kyler was coming up the steps. He and Aline had finished a romantic dinner in the kitchen. Of course, they couldn't go out where people might see them, and Aline was leading him by the hand. V felt his anticipation and disbelief. He probed toward V, but she made herself a stone wall. According to Sister Ariel, the weaves themselves weren't that challenging. It was using them at the strength required for the time required that was difficult. Layer upon layer of magic surrounded the bond, weaving it like fog, and in moments V knew she was doing it right for two reasons. First, Kyler stopped, bewildered, as he was leaning forward to kiss Aline as they sat on the edge of their bed. Second, V could tell that he stopped leaning forward as he sat on the edge of his bed. Whatever V was doing to mute Kyler's side of the bond, it seemed to be amplifying her own. Panic hit her, making it hard to breathe, but Kyler didn't feel it. She could tell he didn't feel her. He wondered at the absence, and then joy spread through him like a fire. He pulled Aline into his arms and kissed her passionately. It was hard to breathe. She'd kissed men, of course, and had dozens more kiss her. She'd avoided it when she could, wishing she could be as numb there as below, but it was part of her work to kiss convincingly. Feeling Kyler kiss Aline was something different. It was fresh and innocent and full of rejoicing, and it deepened. And V felt Kyler's surprise at the ferocity of Aline's passion. He fell, was pushed back onto the bed, and she settled on his hips. Then he was kissing her again, fumbling with the ties of her dress.
Yes. Fuck. Fucking fuck.
It was too bad the weaves weren't harder, because she needed the distraction. Aline was scared, V realized, and embarrassed because she knew exactly what V was doing in here in this room. Either way, Kyler was soothing her, lying by her side, his left arm under her head and his right arm embracing her, caressing her while he spoke soft assurances and slowly awakened her passion. V had fucked so many times with so many men in so many ways, she thought she knew pretty much everything about sex. But Kyler and Aline, in their mutual ignorance, were experiencing something she never had. Their lovemaking fit into a pattern bigger than itself. There was no awkwardness even in their fumbling, because there was no fear of judgment.
Oh, fuck me!
V lost the thought. Whatever Aline was doing, she was either naturally gifted or Kyler was extremely sensitive. Either way, the wave of pleasure through the bond was overwhelming. V's cheeks felt like they were on fire. Then V felt Kyler's mischievous grin. Damn it, it felt exactly the same way it looked. And his own pleasure faded into the pleasure of pleasuring.
You bastard!
I hate you!
I hate you! I hate you!
When V fucked, she put on a persona like a mask. Always. Kylo was making love as a whole man. Every aspect of himself was present, and V knew then that she loved him. She'd been attracted to things about Kylo from the first time she saw that damned mischievous grin in Count Drake's house. She'd admire how he tried to leave the Way of Shadows, how he treated Aline and Yuli. She'd appreciated his excellence in fighting. She'd felt a twinge of infatuation long ago. But then, she'd once been infatuated with Jarl, who was homosexual. In the past month, she'd even come to accept that she desired Kylo. But all those things weren't love. Perhaps she never would have known what love was if she hadn't talked so much with Aline, and if she hadn't felt it daily in Kylo's feelings for Aline. Something banged into the wall inches from V. Her eyes widened. The magic almost escaped her, and only her fear of what would happen if it did helped her regain control. She scrubbed the wool against her arm. Fuck, she hated wool.
Dead babies! You're dead women. Back here so long you prayed it. Moonblood. Vomit!
V bit the wool and held onto the magic for dear life. A few moments later, V could breathe again. She checked the magic as a deep sense of ease and restfulness and well-being and intimacy and peace with the entire world rolled over Kylo. The magic was still intact. V grabbed the pitcher of wine and drank from it directly.
It's a good thing you're a virgin, Galar. Were a virgin. I don't think I could have handled that for much longer.
V realized something at apparently the same time Aline did. Kylo was still aroused. He asked a question, and Aline's answer was unmistakably and passionately affirmative. Pleasure arced through Kylo again. Oh, gods, it was going to be a long winter. As winter slowly faded in Kaliras, Dorian arrayed his army on the plain north of the city to face the invaders from the freeze. The ground was still covered in melting snow that their feet churned into freezing slush. Every breath steamed a protest against battle in such conditions. The wild men who inhabited the freeze always fought bravely, but their only tactic was to overwhelm a foe by throwing a larger army at it. Once engaged, they fought man to man, never as a unit. Since its founding, Kaliras had never been taken by the brutes, though a few times it had been a near thing. Garrath had always said that the wild men had proportionally more talented men and women than any people in the world. The armies faced each other as the sky turned from inky blue to ice blue with the rising sun. God King Wanhope's lines were only three deep, arrayed over as much of the plain as 20,000 men would stretch. The wild men's army dwarfed his and stretched much further and more thickly. There was no way Wanhope could keep them from flanking his army. In the middle of the wild men's line, there was one huge block that the men shunned. If Dorian's reports were correct, he faced 28,000 Krall and even more wild men. 3-1 odds, Dorian smiled, fearless. The current of prophecy was streaming past him, and he saw 1,000 deaths. 10,000.
Lord, are you feeling well?
Dorian hadn't wanted Janine to have to see this, but he'd been counting on Janine more and more. Not only for her advice, either. He blinked and focused on her. Her features were splitting off so sharply that he could barely see her as she was now. Pretty, lips pale from the cold, bundled in furs. Flickering in front of her was a woman hugely pregnant with twins, and a woman with a crushed skull, features unrecognizable under the gore.
No. No, not well at all. But well enough that I won't let my men die.
From this distance, the grotesque features of the Krall weren't visible, though their plainly naked gray flesh was. That nakedness gave Dorian hope. The Krull were created with magic, but they were creatures of flesh. The cold would cripple and kill them eventually. It wasn't easy to force the Krull to wear clothing, as it wasn't easy to rein them in from slaughter, but each could be done. That the wild men's shamans hadn't meant their control was tenuous. Dorian gave an order, and the slaves lowered his palanquin to the ground. God King Wanhope stepped out and advanced onto the plain alone. Palming an obsidian knife, he shrugged off the priceless ermine cloak and let it fall to the mud. It was a gesture that would have infuriated him had he seen his father do it. Now, he understood. To protect what he loved, he had to keep control. To keep control, Wanhope had to be a god. A god was above ordinary concerns like ruining a cloak that cost more than 50 slaves. The currents of prophecy were rising at the pressure of 70,000 futures that Wanhope held in his hands. On his choices, tens of thousands would live and die. He looked at the army opposing him and saw 10,000 ravens swirling over them, waiting to feed. He blinked, and the ravens were gone. Then blinked again, and they were back. But they weren't ravens, nor did they only swirl over the wild men. Dorian turned, eyes wide. Wispy, dark figures swarmed over his entire army, clotted the air above his men, darting this way and that. Here, six perched on a single man, their claws sunk deep into his flesh. There, only a single dark figure spun around another warrior, stabbing in one place and then another, as if trying his defenses. But those were the exception. Almost every man in Dorian's army had at least one figure clinging to him, and there were ranks among them. Some were far more terrible. Dorian looked at General Naga nearby. A trio of the monsters clung to the man, two perched on his shoulders, one licking ephemeral blood from the general's fingers. His clothes. Dorian could see their features. One had a cancer that swelled one eye grotesquely. Open, suppurating ulcers dotted their golden-skinned faces, dribbling black blood onto robes so black with that blood that Dorian could barely tell that they had once been white. It was those shredded robes, dripping ephemeral blood, that made them all look like ravens. The cancered one dipped his claws into General Nada's skull and drew them out again and licked its claws greedily. But they weren't claws. They were finger bones, denuded of their golden flesh. It turned its good eye to Dorian.
What is he looking at?
Dorian turned, and for a moment, he could see with his natural vision once more. Every one of his men was staring at him, fearful. Then his vision bifurcated, and he could see fear rise like a fragrance from his men, to the delight of the swirling strangers. He felt the fingers on his shoulders, bony fingers, but before he could turn to face what he knew must cling even to him, he felt natural fingers grab his bicep and squeeze hard. Janine swam into his vision, which was natural once more. Then it split. She was pregnant, right now, but not with twins. A stranger spun in tight circles around her, but hadn't yet found a place to rest. By the god, it wanted their baby.
Dorian!
I'm back. I'm here. Oh, thank you.
Dorian willed himself not to see beyond the veil again. He looked over his shoulder, nodded to General Naga to let the frightened man see that Dorian was well, and then strode forward. Beneath the cloak, Dorian, Wanhope, had decided to go bare-chested. A god felt not the cold. He strode forward, decisive, to cover for his earlier hesitation. Great nuts of beer rising on his skin. He gestured, and a young man was brought forward. The young man's name was Udric Ursul. All of the Aethelings in Kaliras had been killed, but 17 who'd already left for their harrowing still lived. Udric had impregnated the wrong Modaini oligarch's daughter and had to flee, thus failing his Urdthon. He'd come home to beg mercy.
Do you know, Udric, if you raise 13 legions of Krull, you can command them yourself. But if you raise just one more, You have to master an arcane ghoul.
A what?
It's a creature that these wild men didn't dare try to master. Tell me, brother, is it better for one man to die or the whole people?
Dorian felt, or imagined, the jubilation of a thousand strangers.
Garkendulus, come! Be known to me!
Green lightning danced around him. A train of blue fire looped around him. Then the ground began to boil around Udric's corpse. Flares danced over Udric, and the corpse's muscles tore, skin ripped. The shamans saw their mistake. They hadn't dared raise an Archangelus, and Dorian had. A bolt of lightning cracked the earth before Wanho, blinding him. Thunder ripped over him and over both armies, dropping men to the ground on both sides. Then Wanhope's vision returned. There was a man standing where Udric had been, and every eye was on him. He was easily 7 feet tall, with hair of molten gold falling to the nape of his neck. Though his skin was the color of polished silver, it wasn't shiny or artificial. His eyes were an arresting emerald of a shade barely within human possibility. Perhaps one man in a million had such eyes. Perhaps mimicking Wanhope, he too was bare-chested, though his body was lean and angular. He was the most beautiful man Wanhope had ever seen.
We're strangers, God King, not monsters.
What is your name?
I am Beelzebian, Lord of the Serpents.
Awfully cold in the freeze for a snake.
I'm not in the freeze anymore, am I?
I would have you serve me, Beelzebian.
And I would have the sun and the moon bow down to me.
But one of these things will happen.
I am stronger than you.
It is only the will and the call that matters. I have called you, and my will is implacable.
The stunning green eyes locked onto his, and Dorian had only to think of how Janine would be taken if he didn't compel this snake. He felt the Archangelus's will rise against him, higher and higher. Beelzebane was ever so much more than this body before Dorian. He was immortal, omnipotent. There was nothing Dorian could do to stop him. It was hopeless. He should bow and beg for mercy. Dorian knew that this was the Archangelus's attack, and he held on to what he knew. The Archangelus would obey, would bow, would serve.
I am God King! I am implacable! I will destroy those who challenge me! I will not serve! I am a god!
Very well, God King. I will serve you.
Where is my half-brother, Moburu?
He attempted to take over the 10 tribes. He failed. Only 1 tribe joined him. But he did take enough bones to raise a legion of Krull. He's heading for Black Barrow. But it isn't Moburu you have to worry about.
Neph.
Yes. Neph is the one who taught the wild men to raise Krull. All this was nothing more than a diversion to keep any Ursul away from Black Barrow.
What's he trying?
To make himself God King. Whether by raising a titan or by giving Kali flesh.
Surely Neph Dada didn't mean to raise Kali herself. It would be madness. If what Dorian had seen of the stranger's nature was true, giving their leader flesh would be inviting the devastation of all Midgiru. The good news was that no one since Rhaegaris or Sul had been powerful enough to raise Kali. A titan, on the other hand, was far more probable and plenty frightening enough. Where in the stranger's hierarchy did a titan fall? Two ranks above Baelzebane? Three? By the god! But all that was a conversation for another time.
To claim the wild man's kraal, we must strike down the shaman who controlled them, correct? Who is it?
Baelzebane pointed to a wild man covered completely in woad tattoos. The man had dozens of shields surrounding him, both his own and other magi's. But as Baelzebane gestured, the shield simply melted away. Wanhope threw a single green fiery missile at the man. Watched it contemptuously, secure in his shields, and it burned a hole in his chest. He died with a shocked look on his face. Baelzebane smiled, and Dorian noticed something strange in how the skin crinkled at the corners of his eyes. The Archangel's skin was made of thousands of tiny scales.
Master, what would you have the fallen?
Kill the wild men. No feeding until nightfall, and then load the bones onto the wagons. We may need them to make more kraal at Black Barrow.
As you desire.
By the time he straightened, the wild men's army was already breaking as the crawl in their own ranks turned on them.
Spring is upon us.
V joined Aline on the balcony, still sweating from her exertions, with the hundreds of magi practicing in the yard below. Kyler was outside the city, training with his master again, and Aline had asked to meet. V tried to swallow away the lump in her throat as Aline turned and smiled at her.
You've been avoiding me.
V wanted to say that she'd been busy. She had. The chattel were gathering. Women were joining V's shield sisters every day. Messages had to be passed secretly to the speaker, and always tactics and magic had to be practiced. But all those weren't why she hadn't met with Aline. The past 2 months had seen them grow strangely closer, but the coming of spring was a naked sword.
I need your advice, V. I know how Kyla's gift works, and you also know how his mind works. I'm afraid he'll try to do something stupid to save me if...
If what? Shit! You're pregnant!
A healer confirmed it for me this morning. I'm 1 month along. Haven't even had a touch of morning sickness. Lucky, I guess. It complicates things.
I can make you tansy tea.
If I wanted it to die, I'd just wait a month. God, that's the most stupidly callous thing anyone has ever said to me.
This is why you never let anyone in. If you do, they shit all over you.
I'm sorry. I'm feeling really emotional and upset. But that doesn't make it right to take it out on you. You're not stupid. I'm sorry.
But I am callous.
You've been through hell, V. You are callous, but less and less every day. And I'm sorry I said that. Can you forgive me?
Yes. What do you need?
Aline smiled slowly, and it was like the sun breaking through dark clouds. When she smiled unself-consciously, she was beatific. It wasn't a courtesan's beauty, though the gods and V knew that Aline had spent a lot of time in the last 2 months exploring the courtesan's skills and pleasures. Yet it was feminine and utterly alluring. When Aline felt joy, it was always joy shared. Her naivete in expecting the best from others somehow drew out the best in them.
I'm glad you're my friend, V. I've been meaning to have this talk with you for a while.
She scowled, uncertain how to begin. V felt the lump rise again in her throat, but there was no leaving, no escaping.
I'm going to die. I'm scared, especially with this.
Aline put her hand on her stomach protectively.
I've complained to the god a lot about it, to tell you the truth. I know you think I'm either totally holy or totally deluded. But I've asked God every way I know how to let me live without disrupting his plan. I want to live, and I want Kyla to live, and I want our baby to live. And I want Kyla to do all the things God created him to do.
And what's your God say?
He says he's with me.
Well, that's helpful.
Yes. Kyla thinks... Kyla fears that he's a man born to be forever alone. He thinks the last couple of months has been him cheating fate. He's not a man born to be alone, V. But some lies take a long time to heal. I don't have time. When I'm gone, I want you to take care of Kyla. In every way, he is the most precious thing in all this world to me. And I trust you with him. He'll need you. You'll know when he's ready. And when you are.
V had thought of it, of course. As she sat in her room with the newlyweds canoodling on the other side of a not thick enough wall, she'd thought of it 100 times. This torture wouldn't last forever. Aline would die come spring. Worse, she'd thought that once Aline was dead, she might have Kyla herself.
I've been selfish. I knew we only had a couple of months, so I've been selfish for myself and for Kyla. I know you've paid the price for that. I've seen your face some of the mornings after... After Kyla and I stayed up late. I know you love him, V. And I can't imagine how I would have felt if our places were reversed. If I were in your place. I'd look forward to... this ending. It's all right.
It's not all right to wish your friend was dead.
For that and anything else you may have thought or done, I forgive you, V. Everything really is going to be all right. God has a purpose in this, even if we don't see it.
You're leaving?
Yes.
And you haven't told him?
I've tried. Kyla's not ready to hear it. V, help him know that loving again is no betrayal. He's immortal. And living forever without love is hell.
When are you leaving?
Now.
Where?
King Gaia's marching into Kalidor in a few weeks. There are women in his army. I'll join them. At least that's my plan. God might have something different for me.
Why join them?
To force Kyla to be there. He's sworn he wouldn't leave me again for Logan. But that's where he needs to be. If nothing else, I'll die fighting for something.
You're not a warrior, Aline.
No, but I am a fighter.
Do you have any idea what Kylar will do when he finds out?
I've left a letter for him on the table, telling him that I'm staying at the Chantry overnight. I hope I lie better in writing than in person, because I'll need a head start. But here's another letter that tells the truth. Well, not the whole truth. I didn't tell him I'm pregnant. He's going to hurt enough. Please make sure he gets it.
Aline handed the note to V.
You're putting me in the middle of this?
He'd feel your complicity through your bond. You might want to stay at the Chantry for a couple days.
Aline hugged her. At first awkwardly, and then fiercely. V hugged her back. Her eyes teared up faster than she could blink away, and through her bond, she felt Kyler's sudden alarm from a mile away. But she could feel his wonder.
Are you crying?
She sent a wave of reassurance to him, which left him even more befuddled.
I don't want you to go.
You mean that. I can tell. Even with how hard this has been, you mean it.
I've never had a friend. I don't want to lose you.
You're a better woman than you know, V. God bless you.
The passes are clear. The Magi are going to march tomorrow.
Kyler had known there was something different in his master's attitude as they'd sparred today. They sat together on a table in the practice room of Durzo's house, each holding a towel and blotting the sweat from their faces. Durzo didn't make eye contact.
You're leaving.
If you can believe it, Yuli's kicking me out the door.
I thought you were getting along great.
She's worried about her mom. Says I should have gone to her first.
I think Yuli's smarter than both of us put together.
Watch out for women smarter than you, kid. By which...
You mean all of them. I know.
Guess I need to give you your gear. You going with the Maje?
If I go, Aline will go, and she'll die. I'm steering clear of this fight.
I told you that's not how it works. She can fall in a puddle and drown as easily as take a sword in the guts. Death won't be cheated, not in this.
I won't let her die. I won't let anyone take her away. Not death, not the wolf, not God himself.
Kid, remember your first time in the antechamber of the mystery. Was there one door or two? It wasn't death or the wolf or the boogeyman that made you immortal. This was your own damn choice.
I became immortal so I could save Aline, not so I could kill her.
You want her to live forever? Go ahead. See if you can make another deal with the wolf so someone else will die in her place. Maybe you can choose which one of the other people you care about dies. Won't that be fun? Maybe then you can get a Kakari for Aline, so she won't age. But be glad that the other Kakari's immortality isn't like your own. She won't age, but she can still be killed. And be glad for that, too. Because when she becomes a monster, corrupted by the very gift you sold your soul to give her, you'll be the one who has to do something about it.
I can't let Aline die for me.
You haven't got any goddamn choice. You've had a few months to get used to the idea. That's more than the wolf ever gave me. Be grateful. Now take your shit and get out.
He opened the bureau, released the bottom drawer, and pulled it out. He lifted Retribution, skinned black with a Kakari from a false bottom. Durzo tossed the big black sword to Kylan. As soon as the Kakari touched his skin, it began shrilling.
Why didn't you listen? I'm trying to tell you. It's gone. 3 months gone. Stop.
Dumbfounded, Kylan stared at the sword. Frustrated by his stupidity, the Kakari sought to sink into the skin of his hand and he let it, forgetting that it would destroy his disguise. As the black metal rushed into him, it revealed a pitted, half-devoured sword blade. Retribution was gone, replaced with a counterfeit that Kyler hadn't noticed when they'd hidden the blade. It was impossible, but someone had stolen his sword before he hid it here, probably when he'd first been gawking like an idiot on the crowded sidewalks of Estachi.
Kid, you have no idea what that sword is. You have to get it back.
Then Kyla felt a V through his bond. She'd been nervous since yesterday, and now he could feel her starting guiltily, as if she felt his emotions. V knew, and she was hiding in the chantry, certain he wouldn't go there. For all his help, the sisters had stabbed him in the back. They'd stolen Retribution.
I know where it is.
The closer Kyler got to the chantry, the more his anger grew. He became more and more certain from V's guilt that Aline was somehow involved too, and that lit a fire in him. He thought he could read her. Yesterday afternoon, he'd gotten her note that said she had some things she needed to work on in the chantry, and she still wasn't back. Timing seemed strange, but there was no doubting V's guilt as he came closer. Having the vastness of the chantry against him blew his rage to a flame. They wanted him passive, tame, emasculated, obedient. He was sick and tired of it. Sick of being worked on by vast, remote powers he couldn't understand or counter. The chantry was like fate, like the wolf, like death itself, working inexorably on the world, on Kyler, and turning a deaf ear to his pleas. When he stepped out of the punt onto one of the chantry's docks, 2 dozen pairs of eyes turned to him, scandalized. Some he recognized from V's training sessions. Others were more hostile. He ignored them and strode toward the double doors that led inside.
Sir, no men are allowed here.
Suck a dick. It'll do you some good.
He walked past her.
Imperator!
Before he could touch the double doors, magic bonds latched onto him arm and leg.
Sir, we don't wish to harm.
Kyler shrugged the bonds off as easily as he might shoo a fly. He turned and looked at the faces of the 2 sisters tasked with guarding the door. They were stunned. One of them was readying a lash of magic.
Don't!
He threw the doors open. V was in a panic upstairs.
Good.
Kyler walked straight down a long hall to a set of huge double doors, 3 times a man's height. Kyler didn't slow. He didn't turn to the right or to the left. There was something beautiful in this simplicity. Someone had stolen Kyler's birthright. He was getting it back. This door was in the way. Help! Help! sisters began standing all around the room, and shields blossomed everywhere. But the first woman on her feet was Sister Ariel. She moved faster than Kylar had ever seen her move, coming straight at him.
What do you think you're doing?
Where's the speaker? She's stolen from me.
You will go no further.
Stop me.
Faster than he thought possible, she did.
Incarnus Artos!
Giant chains of magic lashed his arms to his body, clamped his legs together. Magi around her openly gaped at her sheer power.
You deserve that. Take it, apologize, and come back later.
Kylar had had enough of taking it, apologizing, and coming back when it was convenient for someone else. He was sick of being trapped. He felt something mighty rising within him. Fear flickered over Sister Ariel's face at whatever she saw. Kylar tensed every muscle in his body, physical and magical.
What are you?
Out of my way!
Kylar strode forward. They got out of his way. Estariel Wyant eyed the Alataran ambassador's untouched Utai. Marcus Garin was bordering on 50, bald with a fringe of blonde hair, a small paunch, no bottom, and a restless intelligence in his blue eyes.
There are some troubling rumors we've been hearing that I think we need to discuss. What do you know about this High King?
A little. What we've heard has only told us that you ought to know more than we do. He's Alataran, or at least raised in your glorious country. His name is Moburu Ander, though he claims Ursul blood. We know he's half Lodricari. He led a company of lancers, and he's found a position of some importance among the savages of the Frieze.
He's the adopted son of Aurelius Ander, of a once powerful family that has fallen far in the last two generations. Moburu was adopted at 15. Before that, we can't find any record or recollection of him anywhere. So we give some credence to his claim of Ursul patrimony.
I doubt that an absence of records was enough to make you believe he's an Ursul.
The captain is both intelligent and charismatic. Nothing was ever found to link him to the scandals and disappearances that seemed to swirl in his wake. Last autumn, the king's sister bore a daughter, Eva Lucretia Corazzi. The child and her wet nurse disappeared. At the same time, Moburu led his company, all of them, to a place called Pavil's Grove, where they fought beside the Caledorans. There are wild tales surrounding that, but most of Moburu's company escaped and headed north.
You believe he kidnapped the child?
What I believe has no relevance. Some very powerful people in Skirn insist he did not. They are having a harder time explaining why he has taken an entire company out of our country without leave, though some whisper it's a secret mission for the king. There are generals who don't wish to appear fools, who have not discouraged such whispers. There are even those who claim that Moburu's company itself is trying to recover Eva Lucretia.
It appears to me that this man must be declared a traitor. Otherwise, if he joins Kalidor again, this time to attack us, Alatera will be making war on the Chantry.
The slight wince that passed the ambassador's face told Estariel she had voiced an argument he had presented to his superiors himself.
Our response to Captain Ander will be determined soon, and I promise you will be among the first to know. Now, speaking of sharing intelligence, you never did turn over that intelligence you told us about a few months ago. But let's return to that in a moment. First, we are hoping this House of Learning might tell us more about who this High King is supposed to be, and how one identifies him.
Meaning you won't move against Moburu until you know if he's the real thing?
Meaning it is wise to know all one can about one's enemies and friends.
The High King is a legend, mostly confined to the rural areas of Kalidor, Lodricar, Senaria, and Kura. His coming is not spoken of by any of the prophets recognized by the Chantry. We keep track of prophecy spoken by those who have the perishingly rare talent of prophecy. We think of that one as simply a hope kept alive in Lodricar and Kalidor as a longed-for end to oppression. In Senaria and Kura, it's probably more a wish to be consequential. Something Senaria hasn't been for centuries.
Your pardon, Speaker, but I'm not terribly interested in why they believe as I am in what they believe. Does this have anything to do with the Kuran Regency?
It could. The Battle of Mount Tenji was as crushing for the Kurans as it was for Alitera. King Usasi and his son and 7 daughters were all killed. That was so devastating to the country that after that time, Kuran women were no longer taught the sword. The regency was established both because of the profound respect for tradition ingrained in Kuran culture and the fact that the first regent had no blood claim to the throne. The other contenders realized a regency meant that they themselves could hold power without needing a blood claim, if only they were powerful enough to take it. It suited everyone, and the myth of the coming High King gave them a hope of future glory. Our scholars' best guess is that there was a High King who ruled those lands for a single generation in the dark centuries that followed Jorsen Alkesti's fall.
Wasn't Alkestis himself called the High King?
Rarely. In the early years of his reign, he ruled over 7 kings and styled himself the High King. 3 of the 7, Rigel the Blue, Ainara Silver Eyes, and Itara Lakes, rebelled. After that, Jorsen was Emperor Alkestis. We don't know if the latter High King claimed descent from Jorsen or not. Almost all records of him were lost in the Dark Ages. But he only claimed the lands now encompassing Kura, Senaria, Kalidor, and Lodricar. Not all of Jorsen's kingdoms.
So that's it? A long-dead legend?
Well, the Magi give credence to a prophet or two whom we don't recognize.
And they know more?
They don't know more. They believe more.
By the god's beard, I don't care what's true. I care what people believe. What are these prophecies?
They say he will be a dragon. The accepted interpretation is that he'll be talented, though any conqueror brings fire. They say he will raise a standard of death. I hope that's clear enough. Things aren't going to be all prancing ponies and cuddly kittens. Then the prophecies get strange. They say he'll bring peace. Peace everlasting is a pretty normal staple of prophecies, right? Well, these prophecies say he'll bring peace for 2 years or 18. They say his coming will open the way for the return of Jorsen Alkestis, who will both be taken under his wing and test the metal or taste the metal, it's unclear which, of his sword.
When was this prophecy given?
5 years ago. A magus named Dorian, who claimed to be a rogue Ursul. Not exactly a reliable source.
It sounds like a nightmare.
Yes. And these things tend to spread with a religious fervor once they get started. Even if Moboru is the High King, I'd strongly advise King Alidosius to make sure he never sits in any throne. Not unless you want to invite civil unrest or even civil war to Alitera. Jorsen Alkestis still stirs all sorts of emotions. A High King would itself be bad enough, considering the sheer area such a man would rule. But in the Alkestian prophecies, he is a harbinger. Think what may happen in each of our lands if people really believe that the Lord of Hell is coming in bodily form, that creatures from their nightmares will walk again, that kingdoms are doomed to fall.
Yes. I'll convey all this to the king. Is that all?
No. I need to know if your lancers are on their way.
You ask me this now? After you've only just given me the information which might make the king amenable to such a request?
I gave you the information when we got it. We need those soldiers now.
I told you months ago that without access to whatever intelligence you had about an invasion, we would be unable to grant your request. If you'll pardon an old military man speaking bluntly, we can't send 5,000 lancers every time an old ally gets nervous. That's not what the Accords oblige.
The Accords oblige a robust defense of the Chantry, which seems even more pressing now that Moburu Anders Company and Aliteran Company fought for Kalidor at the Battle of Pavil's Grove. We're facing two enemies here, even without Moburu Anders' men, and each alone may be capable of annihilating us. The fact is, even the 2,000 lancers you have across the border, yes, of course I know about them, probably won't be enough to defend us. The best I can expect is that they will hold our flank against the Lycanoct while we go to Black Barrow.
You're going to Black Barrow?
The Kalidorans have learned to raise Kroll.
Kroll?